Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Todd Cast. Last weekend, despite seven Republicans voting to impeach President Trump, that trial vote failed in the Senate. But while President Trump won, the time for reckoning has come for the Republican Party. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell denounced the president in a fiery speech while the Republicans that voted to convict face censure back home. Can Republicans recover from their civil war, particularly in time for 2022? Later in the show, I'll be joined by a man with a plan. 2016 presidential candidate Evan McMullen is planning to launch his own faction of the party, possibly as a third party. But first, Trump's head isn't the only one Democrats are after. The NAACP has filed a lawsuit alleging Giuliani, Proud Boys, and Oath Keepers were all in violation of a Civil War era statute prohibiting interference with congressional constitutional duties. What all does this mean, and who's next in line? And with the impeachment trial put to bed, it's a month into President Biden's administration, and finally, time to take a hard look at the Biden to-do list. What's next? Plus, we'll discuss the vaccine promise made last night at his town hall. It's time for everyone's favorite topic. It's infrastructure week someday. So joining me to discuss, Annie Carney. She's a White House correspondent for the New York Times, of course, and Jake Sherman, co-founder of Punchbowl News. Welcome to both of you. And Annie, I think I want to start with this. The inauguration was January 20th, but is this Biden's first week of the presidency sort of sans interference?
They would say no, that they've been, you know, relentlessly on message, not talking about Trump, even though all of the rest of us still were. And that, but you could see last night them making the most of finally having the spotlight fully on Biden now that the impeachment trial wrapped up. Congress is out of session. The impeachment trial is over. So Biden made his first trip to Michigan last night. To Wisconsin, for a town hall. Like, that wasn't an accident. That was them capitalizing on having the national attention back on Biden so he could sell his relief plan straight to voters. He has no Republican support right now for that bill, but this was a chance to go make his pitch to regular people. That's kind of like the Joe Biden politicking of the pre-COVID era. We saw a little bit of that last night. So it is sort of a new chapter in that, Donald Trump is, unless he starts doing interviews or something, but even so, he's not the main story anymore, and Biden is. That's what changed.
Yeah. Jake, is the how's your news cycle metabolism? You know, you're a guy, and I think about, you know, look, all three of us, you live this news cycle, right? But you were your previous life in Playbook, where you felt like you lived the cycle. You now have narrowed your focus in some ways to having a Capitol Hill focus, which can allow you to sort of ignore some Trump drama. But I'm curious, how is your metabolism? Are you ready to take it down a notch?
I'm not taking it down a notch. I just don't really care about what Trump says, to be honest with you. And I don't say that for reaction, but until he does something of substance, and I don't mean of substance, I'm not trying to say that whatever, you know, I'm not going to get into the back and forth that he has with McConnell. We noted it. Trump lost and McConnell won. So that speaks enough for itself. And Trump has won one election. He lost seats in the Senate in 18, lost the House in 18, and lost the presidency and the Senate in 20. You know, he's won one election. He's had a movement, but I can't. There's too much, Chuck, going on to chase shiny objects, I think, and that's just my view. And I'll probably get a lot of flack for saying this, but there's too much in the politics of governing. I mean, Joe Biden is trying to pass a $2 trillion bill. Right. That deserves a lot of attention for you know, a thousand reasons, and the people who are subscribed to Punchbowl News want that and want that information. And the politics of legislating, you know, God, I hate to say it, it's actually interesting stuff. Getting stuff done is interesting. Donald Trump calling Mitch McConnell, who, by the way, without Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump's presidency would have been zilch. So his assessment about McConnell is wrong. It's kind of just empty calories, to be honest with you, in my estimation.
You know, Annie, the thing with Trump as a foil for the Democrats, though, is it kept the party united, right?
It did. even as Biden and his staff tried to not wade into impeachment, I wrote a story last week talking about how it actually wasn't a bad thing for him. It was kind of cover for a little bit of confused messaging coming out of the White House. They seem to dramatically scale back their promise for school reopenings in the first 100 days, barely got noticed because the focus was on impeachment. It also served as a unifying factor with progressives. So there was some political benefit to Biden for having the cover of comparison to Trump. The quote unquote scandals that might be happening on his watch were nothing compared to what we were seeing unfold in the impeachment trial. But I think that, you know, it's time to move on. As Jake said, he needs to get a lot done. Last night at the town hall, he said he prays every night that he has the strength to help the country through what needs to be done in the coming years. And I think putting Trump in the rearview mirror at some point will be helpful to him.
Where does the Trump hangover, Jake, help Biden with this COVID? So, I'm sort of giving you a leading question here. I think it's a lot easier to have keep Joe Manchin on the reservation with Donald Trump's insanity in the circulation.
Yeah, I actually think it's like I'll say this, it's like a palate cleanser, right? I mean, Joe Biden is being a completely standard and doing completely normal things, and that helps him. He's boring. He's laying out. I my colleague John Bresnahan, who's my one of the co-founders of Punchbowl News, said he's had more policy papers come to him from the Biden administration in a month than we had from Trump in 4 years. Biden is like, you know, Trump always marveled his White House. It was always funny to see. They say, how can we get this bill through? Well, if you stand a message for more than 5 minutes and assemble coalitions and then work different factions on the Hill, it's a pretty tried and true method. Biden's doing that right now, right? I mean, so I just think that it's helpful for Biden to just do everything that Trump would never do. It's a pretty easy right. governing strategy.
Yeah, you know, it is. Hey, Jake, what happened to the speech to Congress next week, and how did that get punted?
You know, Annie, I'm curious. Annie was in this briefing yesterday at the White House. I had heard. So I don't think the White House ever put a date on the speech, Annie, right? Isn't that right? I think right,
we had heard February 23rd.
Right. So in the briefing yesterday, Jen said this February 23rd date. She said, I have no idea where that date came from. I don't know where that came from. And then she claimed that there was never a plan for the speech to be in February. But in Joe Biden's primetime address last month, he said, when I address Congress next month. So Joe Biden said it was going to be February. I don't know why it was pushed back. But again, this is kind of like I pressed Jen on this in the briefing yesterday, and there was some negative Twitter reaction to that, being like, this is what White House reporters are interested in now.
Get off Twitter.
It was just a reminder.
Twitter is the smoking of the 21st century. No good comes from it. Just
but it was a reminder to your previous point that Joe Biden benefits from the comparison to Trump, especially during impeachment weeks when it was about Trump at his worst. And then when we kind of come back to just understanding the nitty gritty of when was the speech supposed to be? Why is it delayed? The general public thinks this is boring.
Well, can I make one point on that?
Go ahead, Jake.
I think it's crazy that you got any flack for that, Annie, because a speech to Congress in the first couple months is very important. And the president did say it. I do think that, like most bad information, that date came off of Capitol Hill, because I had heard it from someone. I heard it on Capitol Hill and people were just surmising because it was late February. It was when the House and Senate were both in session. So I do think that that's where it came from. But like, it would make sense and it would be normal for Biden to want to give this address. I think it would be very difficult given the health situation.
Well, actually, though, I actually think the timing is actually kind of awkward. And this was the reason why I brought it up. At this point, if your goal for passing this plan is mid-March. Do you want, if you do this speech before then it's a speech that's all about getting it passed. If you wait till you get this done, right, this is emergency legislation, then your speech to Congress really is, let me outline my vision now for the rest of the 4 years. That's why I think the timing of the speech now is kind of important.
Yeah, I think that it depends what he wants his speech to be. I mean, there's a rally the country perspective that you could take before the bill is passed. And then there is a pivot point afterwards. But, you know, I think, Annie, you asked this question, or maybe someone else in the briefing did yesterday, and it caught my ear. And I actually meant to make a bigger deal of this. But someone said, what is your next legislative priority? Mm-hmm. Is it infrastructure? Mm-hmm. And Jen said, we don't know. But that's not where the White House was like a week ago when they were briefing people on background. I think before he took office, they said they're doing the rescue package and then a jobs package.
Right.
Yeah, so, Annie, I'm curious. This feels like them getting nervous that they're going to get grief for not making immigration a priority, which they'd be politically insane if they made that a priority over infrastructure. But it sounds like they're trying to slowly walk back promises on immigration.
I think the question on infrastructure is not trading it for immigration in the lineup, but the question is whether they're doing the big, bold, build back better jobs and economic proposal, or if they're doing a really narrow infrastructure bill where they think that there is room to get something done with.
I hear there's some power grid issues in Texas.
And that's what Jen said yesterday. She said, we don't know. Right. We don't know what we're doing next. Is it a narrow infrastructure bill or the big build back better bill that they
you think that's what she was saying? We don't know. Meaning it's infrastructure, but we don't know how big we're going.
I think that's right. And I don't think they have any details. Biden has another meeting today with labor leaders to talk about infrastructure. These are a bunch of leaders who oppose his decision to get out of the Keystone pipeline. They want to see where he's going to create energy jobs. So he's meeting he's still just doing these meetings, but there's no paper. There's no actual infrastructure plan document to get as a scoop. That doesn't exist yet.
Jake, I know you didn't want to talk about the shiny metal object, but I am curious, what kind of impact do you think McConnell's going to see due to Trump's broadside on his internal Republican conference dynamic?
Zero. The McConnell is not, I mean, listen, there might be sniping around the edges, but Lindsey Graham took his side last night, I saw on Fox News. The Senate majority or minority leader, or any Senate leader for that matter, is not subject to a vote like the Speaker of the House. The Senate majority and minority leader needs to enjoy the support of half of his conference or caucus in the Democrats' case. I could give you 25 Republicans off the top of my head right now that will be with McConnell through hell or high water, 26 Republicans, no matter what the president says. he just has an iron grip over these people. And even if Trump, it would be the wrong fight for Trump to try to pick. It would just be a silly fight. I mean, he has picked it, but McConnell's not going anywhere. Now the question becomes, does Trump have some sort of infrastructure by which he's going to go into races, choose candidates that are against the NRSC's wishes, and run them against candidates that McConnell wants? If that's the case, that could be problematic for McConnell and could probably end up, as we've seen in the past. We've seen this movie before, Chuck, as you know. Like, we've seen outside groups choose candidates. Now, it wasn't Trump, but we've seen, you know, Todd Akin in Missouri. And that's when and candidates of that nature. And that's when McConnell said, wait a second, I'm going to get a grip on this process and start choosing candidates in primaries. He's been very successful in doing that. So, I mean, I'm in a wait and see mode with Trump on how the McConnell thing happens. I mean, Trump remains very popular in the base. I get that. But will he have some sort of discernible or dispositive impact in 2022. I don't know. We need to see what a post-Trump political operation looks like. If it's, you know, if it's anything like we saw of the goof troop lawyers that he had in his impeachment trial, then I wouldn't be too hopeful that he'll be able to stand up a political operation that's worth even paying attention to.
But it is worth noting Rick Scott fashions himself as a Trump whisperer. And he's the guy over at the NRSC. And he's somebody that has dabbled, you know, before he got into politics, he was basically a creature of, you know, the Keith Appel world, if you know what I'm talking about, like the conservative PR world that would always slightly outside of the establishment. So he has relationships with that world that I wonder if it will mitigate the damage Trump could do.
Yeah, I don't know that, you know, I think that, yeah, that, I guess that's possible. And Rick Scott, remember, as you know, Chuck, has higher ambitions, right? I mean, Rick Scott wants to be president of the United States, or so it seems. So, you know, I think that will be an interesting position for him. But if Trump has some sort of longstanding beef with McConnell, that is like any of the other beefs that he's had in the 4, 5, 6 years that we've been watching him on the public stage, then I don't know who's going to be a good kind of middleman to help ease the tensions.
Annie, Congress is not over Trump. Biden might be over Trump, but congressional Democrats are not over Trump. What's the Biden White House sort of mindset on what is clearly still going to be a Capitol Hill focus on the reckoning of the Trump era?
I think they're happy to see Congress do so. They've said that they support Pelosi doing a 9/11 style independent commission to investigate what happened on January 6th. They're supportive of Congress members like Representative Benny Thompson, who sued Trump in his personal capacity for the harm he suffered on January 6th, having to be stuck in the chamber on the floor wearing a gas mask for 3 hours, thinking he might die. They are saying we're supportive of all of these, but they think that's Congress's job, and they are going to be continuing to work on the relief plan and the stimulus package and all that. They're not going to do more than say, we support you.
Kamala Harris, Annie, do we have a good idea of what her role is going to be yet? Because I feel like it isn't obvious yet.
I agree with you. I think it is still in flux. She clearly is, the White House is giving her a lot of FaceTime with Biden. They're including her in all of the meetings he's taking in the Oval. She's always at his side. I think that Biden, you know, as a former vice president, that understands that position can be difficult. He hasn't given her a specific, so he's including her and is positioning her as his partner. It's both, you know, respectful of her and as a vice president, understanding that.
Well, I saw she did a call with Macron, right? She's going to do leader calls.
Yes.
Right. I saw
what
that.
What he hasn't given her yet is like her own specific portfolio that she's in charge of.
Right. That's what's
So that would help us understand more specifically what her job is, other than the person who's always sitting next to Biden in meetings. She did the Today Show today to talk up the relief plan. She got a little backlash for a statement she made about disregarding CDC guidelines about opening schools. We saw her kind of anger Joe Manchin when she went to West Virginia, right, to some local press there. This is a political figure who got this job after coming off of a presidential campaign where she just had a failure to launch after a very big launch. It was just a mess. It was not clear what she stood for. And now she has a chance to redefine herself. Mm-hmm. And it's still just a month in. I think we'll see more. But I don't have a clear sense yet of what she's doing other than being deferential and loyal to Biden so far.
Jake, what's the view on her from Capitol Hill? What do they expect? What role is Capitol Hill Democrats?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I wonder, so I'll broaden it out a little bit, Chuck. Who plays the Mark Meadows, Joe Biden role for right, Joe Biden.
The last two presidencies. Yeah. That's what yeah, I who, yes, you read my mind.
Who yeah. comes up here for the administration? I mean, is Joe Biden coming up here negotiating deals with Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer? Don't think so. I just don't see that happening.
You picture Kamala Harris and Mitch McConnell doing
no,
that?
I don't think that Mitch, I don't think that, I don't think so, for a variety of reasons. You know, and I'm not diminishing, I think Kamala Harris is incredibly skilled. I just don't know that she, I don't know that that dynamic between Schumer, McConnell, and Kamala would be a, you know, yeah, I don't know if it would be a useful dynamic. Is it Ron Klain? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think it's Kamala Harris. I don't know that they see that as, and I would defer to Annie on this. I don't know that they see that as her, you know, as her kind of universe. I just,
well, I think they've always seen Biden as the guy that's going to do the Hill outreach, not her.
It's interesting. The White House people I've spoken to say the happiest they've seen Biden so far is when, the Democrat senators came to the White House to talk to him. And the second happiest they saw him was when the Republican senators came. He loves the Senate. That's what he loves. That's where he's from. But also, I do.
This so is a, happy. Can I just tell you that makes
but that
me
question
so
for Jake is just like
our first president. I mean, I've never had a president in my lifetime that liked Congress.
My question for Jake is like, are his relationships in Congress a little outdated at this point?
Yes, of course. He, yeah. hasn't been in the Senate since 2008.
Right.
I mean, I've been back and forth with some colleagues on a text message about this. I mean, the people that he served with many of them are no longer here.
Right.
Remember, I mean, Chuck, I think you and I have talked about this before, whether it was on air or not, I don't remember. But like, think about the Senate that he served in. The Senate he served in had two Democrats from Arkansas.
And by the way, the Senate he served in had four Democrats from the Dakotas.
Right. Like, okay. The Senate he served in doesn't even come close to resembling the Senate of today.
Right.
And I'm not saying he doesn't understand the institution, but you know, you could understand the institution without understanding its current dynamics. I mean, I think they're way overrated. Another thing that's overrated, sorry, Annie, just one more thing. Yeah. His relationship with Mitch McConnell's overrated.
Yes.
Like, they prevented calamity a few times, but they don't, I mean, yes, they've known each other for 30-something years, and that's meaningful. I just don't see this as a second coming of, you know.
Yeah, this ain't Tip O'Neill and Reagan.
No,
I agree. No. I agree. Annie, you want to finish?
Yeah, no, I was just going to add that I think Jake's exactly right, that even if it was appropriate for Biden to be his own messenger on the Hill, that he's probably not, it wouldn't be for the best, for exactly what Jake just outlined.
Well, you know what? I enjoyed this. This was the most normal Washington political discussion that we've been able to have, that I've been able to have in 6 years. So with that, Annie and Jake, I hope you have a busy, normal week.
Thanks, if you Chuck.
I mean, I have to say, I felt this on Sunday morning after doing the show on Sunday. Like, I think we finally turned the page. I'm not saying he disappears, but I do feel like we've turned an important page.
I think that's true.
Anyway,
thank
all right,
you,
guys.
Chuck.
Onward.
All right.
I'm going to pause there. We'll be right back after a quick break to talk with Evan McMullen. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press.
And joining me now to talk about the future of, I'd say, conservatism as a political movement is Evan McMullen. He, of course, ran for president as an independent, as a counter to Donald Trump back in 2016. And he is now working to try to figure out where do Republicans who are not for Donald Trump go next. Evan McMullen, welcome to the Toddcast. And so, Evan, let me start there. Mm-hmm. Are you a Republican or not?
Well, great to be with you, Chuck. I am a registered Republican, but as I often say, I already have a family and a religion. And so I've never looked at my political party to replace either. I'm committed to founding American principles and actually to the founding principles of the Republican Party and first and foremost to the country, to its interests over party interests and to the interests of the American people. And that's what has always driven my political activity.
So would you say, I mean, you know, one of the things I like to remind people is the Republican Party is the most successful third party in our history.
True.
And which also means that parties can come and go. It takes a while, but they can. Do you believe, are you trying to reform the party from within, or are you now, are you getting ready to give up on the ability to do that?
I don't think I'm ready to give up, but I am exploring with a whole lot of other people, Republicans who, like me, desire a new direction for the party. And by the way, Chuck, we aren't just people who have opposed President Trump for years. We also have people with us who served in the Trump administration, who voted for Trump once or twice in the past. Mm-hmm. But there's a growing number of Republicans who desire a new direction, especially after the January 6th insurrection. And we're having those discussions about whether we can change the course of the Republican Party, certainly not changing everything, but changing, recommitting it to foundational American values, to democracy, to truth. We're talking about whether it's possible to do that from within, or whether we need to do that from without, or if it's actually a combination of the two. And that's where the discussion is now.
You know, it's fascinating if you, and I don't know how much of this sort of deep research you've done so far, or if people have done this, but, you know, this current takeover of the Republican Party began about 10 years ago by the Ron Paul acolytes, who all methodically ran for these low-level state committee positions. And then they morphed into the Trump wing of the party. And they control this infrastructure. I mean, it's fascinating to see these censure resolutions. Like the gentleman from Pennsylvania who says, Pat Toomey shouldn't use his best judgment. And I'm thinking, do you even understand what the word republic within Republican even means?
Right.
I mean, like, so I guess the reason I ask that is like, is this possible from within? Because I don't think folks realize the extent of the infrastructure takeover of the what was the Ron Paul wing of the party, which was a bit fringy, and which has morphed into Trumpism.
Right. So, look, I think about the Tea Party, for example. One thing that is different between the situation that the Tea Party existed in and the one we, the 25 to 30% of the Republican Party who want a new direction for it, one thing that's different is that I think that the Tea Party, if we're looking at that, had actually the base on its side, or a large, large portion of the base. It was Republican leadership that was out of touch with the voters in the Republican Party. And that's not to say the voters necessarily had it right, and it's not to say that leadership had it right. But the point is, just from a political strategic perspective, the Tea Party understood that the base was with them at least as much as another portion of the base was with leadership, or maybe more so with them. And so what they could do is operate within the Republican Party exclusively. They tried to advance their candidates through primaries. When they were successful, then of course they supported them in the general elections. But if another Republican won, they didn't go out and support the Democrat. They continued to support Republicans. So what's different in our case is that we are a minority inside the party. We recognize that. But I'll say, Chuck, that you're speaking with me, someone who is, among others, who have gotten used to fighting for a new direction for the Republican Party with 10 to 15%
right.
of the party. That's what we did for the last 4 to 5 years. Now, after the insurrection, our numbers are growing to 25 to 30% of the party. They have different views on impeachment and conviction and a range of things. They voted for Trump or didn't, but they want a new direction for the Republican Party, but still we're in the minority. And so I don't think we're in a position to change the course of the Republican Party very quickly, because again, at best, we're a third of the party. So I think we have to think more independently and act, more importantly, more independently than the Tea Party did, for example, when it was arising within the Republican
Party. What does that mean? What does that mean? I mean, so you're still, let me just stop you. You're not interested in organizing an outside force yet, a competitive third party.
No, I am interested in that idea, but I don't see it as either or, Todd. For example, well, let me answer your first the first question, Chuck. Sorry, about what we what we mean when we say an independent, more independent faction of the Republican Party. What it would mean very, very clearly is that, if, say, for example, in Arizona, where you have Mark Kelly, a senator, Democratic senator, unifying figure running for re-election in 2022. He just was elected, obviously. He'll be defending a seat in 2022. If the Republicans then put forth, say, Kelly Ward, who's the far-right extremist leader of the Republican Party in Arizona, then we would support Mark Kelly.
Oh,
Rather
than recruit a third candidate.
Exactly. Will we recruit somebody to run in it, would we support a unifying Republican in the Republican primary? We may. In Arizona, I think it would be very difficult perhaps for that person to make it through, but not impossible. That's something we would look at. But we would be willing to support unifying Democrats in facing extremist Republicans. And that's what makes us different from the Tea Party.
You know, one of the hallmarks of the Republican, of the rise of the Republican Party and what was going on with the Whigs, and then, of course, the brief period of the Know-Nothings, is you did have prominent Whigs decide to change parties. Right. And sort of, you know, the fastest way to get off the ground would be if the 17, I guess you could call them the character Republicans, right? The 17, the 10 impeachers, the 7 that voted to convict. Is that where you would start to see if you could convince them to leave the party for this new entity?
I think we would start more modestly, more likely. But you're absolutely right that a key component of anything new is holding official power through elections. And one way to do that, obviously, is joining forces with Republicans of character, as you put it, who already are in Congress. Another way is to run our own candidates, or to run candidates who present themselves under our banner, even if they're still Republicans. They may be independents, they may still be Republicans. But turning to those who are already elected and this idea of them joining us, those conversations are happening already. I think there is an appetite for among them for something new, but they prefer not a new party, but rather an alliance or a faction within the Republican Party that mm-hmm. stands for truth and foundational values and a lot of some of the traditional ideas of Republicanism in the past, the healthy ideas, but also thinks anew about its place in American leadership. But this would allow these kinds of leaders to associate with something other than just the Republican Party. They would still be Republicans. They would still run as Republicans, but they would run as,
hey, I'm not one of those. I'm not a Trump Republican.
Yeah.
I'm a character Republican or whatever.
Whatever
you guys had, right?
Whatever the brand is. And there are other Republicans who have held major office in the past and who are interested in running again, wanting to turn the tide, wanting to take the GOP in a new direction. They're also asking for such a brand that they can affiliate with rather than just the Republican Party. And I think that's a very powerful opportunity for us.
You know, it's interesting. I think there's a ton of opportunity, but I think your greatest challenge is character is subjective. And while I think we have, like, think about the 17 people. I think about the idea, the voting histories of the 17 people, the 7 convictors and the 10 impeachers. They're pretty diverse ideologically. There's some moderates, some ideological moderates and centrists. There's some old school conservatives, you might say, or religious conservatives, some national security hawks. You know what I mean? There isn't, the only thing that unifies is truth and character. And I guess, is it possible to build a party based on that?
I think that the most important issues facing the country are very similar to the issues that animated the founding of the country in the first place, namely that government should be accountable to the people, that we should have representative government, therefore, and all the things that come with that, that we're all equal under the law, that we're created inherently free. These are the issues that are at stake right now: the separation of powers, the constitutional order. I say again, truth. These are issues. These are policy issues. And in fact, they are the most important issues, in my view, facing the country, because all of the other huge issues, challenges that we face, and there are many, can't be solved without functioning self-governance. Mm-hmm. And so these things that unite us, I think we have a tendency to dismiss them as, oh, these are not real issues. These aren't policy issues that people care about. Well, increasingly they do. And that's what many of us have cared about for years. And that's what I've cared about my entire life. That's what many of us have cared about over the last 4 years. And I think after seeing the insurrection on the 6th, that's what unites and animates those of us who are desiring a new direction for the Republican Party. So I think there is those issues do have the power to unite a lot of Republicans now. And you know, I think we have to go beyond that, of course. I think we need to reevaluate as conservatives our governing philosophy. I think conservatism has been perverted by many forces over time. I would say since the Southern Strategy, and then of course more recently by Trumpism, we've got to reevaluate that and rethink what conservatism is. But at a starting place, it must be committed to founding principles, our democratic republic, and truth, the constitutional order. These things. There's no other way about it.
Have you been studying conservative movements around the world in Western democracies? It feels like they're all struggling right now, that they're all being challenged by this populist insurgent, right? You know, you got your Le Pen movement. Obviously, we saw Brexit. Even right. Australia hasn't been immune to this. Right. Is this something that feels bigger than just an American problem?
Well, look, I think the world is changing, and the populations in the places that you mentioned and in the United States are changing. I mean, we hear all the time about changing demographics in America. And I think there are some who are primarily on the Republican side, if not almost entirely, who have great concern about that, and they shouldn't. And I think we need our leaders to help lead them forward. But it has presented, along with some economic challenges that we've had, in 2007 to 2009, and now the situation we face with the pandemic and the economic crisis that it's caused. There's a lot of anxiety that comes from understandable and healthy places, and some from not so healthy places. And so we now have in America, and I think elsewhere in other Western democracies you mentioned, a resistance to a changing, to a pluralistic society. And conservatism is being used as a facade for a fight against pluralism, yeah. which is to abandon our founding values and the reality that America was and should still be defined by our commitment to our founding ideals, not to the color of our skin or religions or the birthplaces of our citizens. But that's what's happening. And conservatism has become sort of this reactionary, I won't even call it a philosophy or an ideology, but it's about opposing all change, whether guided by prudence or natural, necessity. It's about fighting all change to preserve a certain social and civic order that benefited a certain segment of American society.
Well, we used to fight about which party managed government better, right? And the Democrats might argue, hey, you're not taking care of enough people. And the Republicans might argue, we've got to be more efficient with this. But there was a basic belief that government was good. Let's debate how we use the power, how we exercise it. I think the Tea Party moment broke the governing wing of the Republican Party, right? And the question is, How do you get, can that be brought back, or is that going to take a generation? There's a whole generation that doesn't believe government works and has got involved in politics to dismantle government. They didn't get involved in politics to reform government. They got involved to dismantle it. The extreme version of this is Steve Bannon. And I feel like that is a huge virus inside the conservative movement.
It certainly is. I mean, look, there is a place, and in fact, I think the country needs a healthy party committed to democracy and truth and these things I talk about that stands for limited government. I mean, there is a legitimate governing philosophy that says we're all created free. We have tremendous potential, all of us as individuals and then collectively as well. And we need limited government in order to allow for the greatest flourishing of every individual and collectively the country. And in order to do that, we've got to encourage self-reliance and self-responsibility and all of these things. And so that's a healthy governing philosophical thought and approach. But that healthy thought, again, has been co-opted by people who really just envision America as a place for a certain kind of people who believe a certain way, who look a certain way. And so they use the idea and have since the Southern strategy of a limited government to withhold support and help that certain peoples need in the country under the name of limited government, when it's really about protecting a country for a certain group of people and not for another. And that's developed. And you're right. The Republican Party really has become an anti-government party, an anti-democracy party. And that can't be where we are. I think where we will be positioned on the center right is still favoring limited government, but recognizing the vital role that government has to play in helping our vulnerable, helping them not just sustain themselves, but thrive again. Government has an important role to play there. It needs to be, it should be as limited in our view as I think it can be, but it needs to be effective. And it also has a role to play for the common good. And we certainly will embrace and defend that.
So let's fast forward. It's election night, 2022. How will what will you like to see happen that will make you feel as if your this movement that you're trying to help spark has had some success? What does success look like to you in 2022 and in 2024?
In 2022, I think it would look we would defend those Republicans who are doing the right thing. They may not have always done the right thing, but they are standing on principle now, putting the country first, to defend them and to make sure as many of them keep their seats as possible. I think is where we need to be, and we would certainly look to that.
Liz Cheney, Lisa Murkowski getting reelected is a good night for you.
Adam Kinzinger, exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's going to be hard for some of them, but I think that's important. Another thing would be to replace some of the more extreme voices within the Republican caucus in the House, especially right. Marjorie Taylor, Andy Biggs, Paul Gosar and others. That's more difficult. Obviously, they come from deep red districts, and that's more difficult. But I don't think it's impossible. If we find the right candidates and mobilize the right people, I think that that's possible. And then the last thing I would say is by 2022, a stronger, independent, movement or alliance, either within the Republican Party or acting independently of it, sort of within and without at the same time, something developing with some real strength by then is another thing I'd like to see.
Well, I'll tell you this. Those members of Congress you're thinking about targeting, and I spend a lot of time in Matt Gaetz's district, it's amazing at how little time he focuses on his local politics. And Pensacola's had a bridge out forever, and it's little things like that. I think those guys that have all, gotten bit by the fox bug, all have more vulnerabilities if they got primaried by a real local politician.
I think you're right, Chuck. What people don't realize is these kinds of figures in Congress, especially in the House, but in Congress more broadly, in the Senate as well, everyone who knows what goes on in Congress knows that those members get nothing done. They don't pass bills.
They bring nothing home.
They do nothing. They do nothing. So I do think they're vulnerable. And by the way, you know, my organization, Stand Up Republic, we led a 2.5 year fight against Steve King. We were the largest outside players in his race in the midterms. And then we invested in also in the primaries in 2020, ultimately to take him out. And one of the things, one of the points we made is we made our case to principled and moderate Republicans in his district was that he had gotten nothing actually done. Right. And you're right. I think it's a compelling argument and it applies to most of them.
Yeah. Especially in midterm years when the presidential race doesn't overshadow things. Well, Evan McMullen, we'll be watching. Good luck. I think all of America should root for two political parties that have a foundation in basic things like good character and pro-democracy.
No doubt about it.
I don't think those are controversial.
They shouldn't
controversial
be.
Controversial things anyway. Evan, good luck and stay safe and ignore the trolls.
Thank you. We'll see you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer. Our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1, The Big Show every Sunday morning, and of course, on demand on Peacock. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.